So we do turn back to the book of Genesis as we continue to walk through. Anyone want to make comments on this kind of this section that we're walking through about Abraham? What are some of the lessons that we've been learning about the book of Genesis? How does this section play in? And what are some of the, just lessons learned as we've walked through? Last week we watched as Abram battled the kings. And then we, of course, saw in chapter 15 the promise of a son. Weeks before that, we saw the Abraham and Lot and the decision there. And we saw Abraham's initial call and the famine and going down to Egypt. But so what were some of those key themes that we've been seeing as we walk through this book? God's plan cannot be thwarted. So therefore, just tying in with that, God's faithfulness to his word, the fact that he does not change his plans, and nothing can, as you said, thwart his plans. Good, that's a major emphasis of this section. What else? What about just Abram and Abraham as we've walked and watched, in one sense, it's the story of him, in one sense, the story of God working through him. But what have we noticed about Abraham through here?
His faith.
His faith, absolutely. Certainly we've seen his triumphs of faith and also his failures of faith. See both aspects of those and how God works through him. And yet at the same time, even through his failures, God continues to work through him. And so we've seen him contrasted with Lot. We've seen just in his faith and willing to give up the good lands to Lot, even though he was the older and the patriarch of the family, he gave that choice to Lot because he believed that God would fulfill his promise. He wasn't worried about getting the promised land because he knew God had promised, and so therefore he could give the decision to Lot. God's going to work it out. He could be selfless and God's still going to bless. And yet we also see his failures, how he lied about his wife. You know, and yet God preserved Sarai even through that failure. Certainly we've seen God's covenant with Abram run throughout here. Certainly as it starts off in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, God's desire to make him into a great nation, to bless him and to bless the world through him. And then certainly in chapter 15, we see the transition. The first part of this section more emphasizes the land, and here we're more starting to emphasize the seed and the promise that God gave to him that one from his own body will be his heir. And we remember last week that we looked at chapter 15, that key section where God split the animals, remember, and made this covenant with Abram and made it a unilateral covenant that God will certainly fulfill his promises to Abram. And so that definitely ties in even with what Hannah was saying, just that God's plan, God's purpose will be fulfilled, right? It cannot be broken. And so when God gives his word, it's sure. And so all these themes really tie together, right? That therefore you could trust God. Therefore you could believe in God. You could walk with him in trust and faith because you know he will do what he said. And so we see Abram continue to walk in faith. And we'll, as we continue to walk through these stories, really, it's just these same themes that just keep coming out in the life of Abraham. We see faith. We see challenges to faith. We see both aspects of it. And I think that's so informative to us because we, of course, are challenged. You know, it's one thing just to see the life of someone who lives in perfect obedience, but to see his failings is so instructive to us to see where he lacked faith and just how destructive that can be, in one sense, even to God's plan, even though God is in control of his plan. And so you see that God, really so much the message of this section is God is going to work out his promises no matter what. They're unconditional. And yet God works through men of faith. God works through women of faith and those who trust in him. And so we will continue to see those things. We see, you know, saw in chapter 14 how God blessed Abram with this amazing victory over this, as we talked about, this international battle scene. And certainly it just all ties back to the beginning of this section that God said, I will bless you. And so we see Abram being blessed in so many ways. And then as we talked about, even with Lot, we're going to continue to see Lot, even as you mentioned, I think it was last week, you know, we looked at Lot's failing and choosing based on sight and not based on faith. He was looking at the, you know, oh, this looks like the greenest land. And so he chose the land by Sodom. And of course, Josh reminded us of what's going to happen to Sodom. And that's what we'll see how far we get. But I'd like to kind of pick up the pace a little bit, hit some broader sections. Because I think we're seeing how this message plays out and what the theme is in this section. So we can walk through a number of stories in one sense fairly quickly and just see these same themes just keep coming up. And in one sense, it's nothing new, but just new angles on it and new perspectives that will continue to teach us what it means to live a life of faith and how God is faithful and how he works through those who trust him. Okay, so any other comments or questions as we turn to chapter 16 of Genesis? All right, let's turn there, and as we've done, let's deal with the whole narrative as a section. And so we'll go ahead and read all of chapter 16. And just once again, just with these themes and purposes of this section of Genesis in mind, just be thinking, what does this teach us about God, about faith, about trust, about his plan, his purpose to bless the world, and all these things, about the seed, which of course we traced all the way from Genesis chapter 3, and we continue to trace. And so we come to chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. Now I'll just say right off the bat, in Hebrew there's this construction where they can kind of give you some parenthetical information. They don't have parentheses per se, but there's a way of setting aside information as parenthetical. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this in an earlier lecture, but often they'll do that, and they'll give you some key piece of information for the story that is to come. And so here, this is this construction. So they give you this. I think we did mention this at one point. All the way back, I think, in chapter 11 even, or chapter 12. Anyway, but the idea is, okay, so this is this piece of information. It's like, okay, just keep this in the back of your mind. And so as we read that, okay, that's going to be a key piece of information as this story unfolds, as you well know. And so we come to verse 2. So Sarai said to Abram, "Now behold, Yahweh has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children through her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. And after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. And he went in to Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done me by be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May Yahweh judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight, or good in your eyes." So Sarai treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence. Let's just stop there and deal with the first paragraph there of this section. When you read this, what do you think? What does this teach us?
Failure.
Failure? Yeah, certainly this is not a positive situation. The results of it are, you know, Hagar, Sarai's handmaiden, just this animosity and enmity between her and... So you see the end results, obviously, are negative. They're bad. And we'll continue to see, in one sense, negative results from this. Good. What else do we see from here?
Strikes me that Sarah is running the show.
There
Doesn't
you go.
Doesn't say that Abram took her as his wife. Says that Sarai gave her to... Yeah.
Absolutely. Did anyone notice a key phrase in there that ties in very closely with what Aunt Becky just said?
Listen to the voice.
Yeah. Abram listened to the voice of his wife. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
Sound like a guy named Adam?
Yeah.
Right? Listen. Lost his place, didn't take his role as leading and And certainly the disastrous respect, I mean, certainly it's just very similar statement to what it said way back with Eve. So certainly that should tip us off here to the same kind of lesson learned with Adam. Good. What else? What about... what about this little statement here that after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, why that chronological reference? Just throw out ideas at this point.
It's been a while, and like he's starting to lose faith.
Yeah, it's just impatience, right? Yeah, he's you know, it's been a while. They're getting older. You know, what's going on? God, you gave this promise. And so you see just the impatience, the lack of trusting in God over time. You know, they had trusted God for so long, but after 10 years, there was this lapse. And so certainly a major emphasis of this, we've talked about the importance of faith, but even a faith that continues on even over time, right? Even if it seems like God isn't doing anything for a long period of time, 10 years is a long time to wait. And I just reminded from this, just from... for myself, for others, it's so easy to do what is right, but then to persist in it. Just the God says, wait. God says, wait. God says, wait. God just keeps saying, wait. How long do you have to wait? And this, they were waiting 10 years. And so finally they did what? They took action into their own hands, right? They didn't ultimately trust God, but they thought, okay, I know how to solve this, you know? And so they kind of schemed up a plan, if you will, to help God along. And so you see, and then of course you see the disastrous results from what they had done. They took matters into their own hands. They didn't trust God. And so they said, okay, let's do this on our own. They did it from their own power, their own might, rather than dependence on God and trusting in Him. And so you see the result, right? Hagar gets mad at Sarai. And notice even this key word, do what is good in your sight. Or in your eyes, you know, even as you said, certainly it's Abram kind of turning things over to Sarai, but also that statement, you know how we've seen that throughout the book of Genesis, right? Everyone did what was right in his own eyes, you know? And so it goes all the way back to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? This is our word good here, you know, do whatever you think is good. It's not do what God says is good. It's do whatever you think is good. And you see the contrast there. Once again, just these same themes just keep running through this book. And it's just interesting how just those little phrases just keep reminding us over and over again of the same truths. We need to trust God. We need to obey Him no matter what. We need to do what He thinks is good, not what we think is good. Right? And we could trust Him that He knows what is best for us, even if we have to wait a long time. And of course, the flip side, there's blessings for obedience and cursings for disobedience. If we don't obey Him, look at the disastrous results. And so this little narrative, which we all know so well, it becomes so applicable to all of us just to trust in the Lord, to obey Him no matter what. And the more I think about Scripture, and it's interesting, we know so much about Scripture. You know, I think that it's often our problem is not that we don't know what is right. Right? Our problem is, like Abram, like Sarai, we get impatient, we lack trust, and we know what's right, but we don't persevere in it, or we don't trust enough to do it. And so I love just walking through the book of Genesis where this same point just keeps getting nailed home. We need trust, we need faith, we need to see with spiritual eyes, so that we'll continue to do that which we know is right. And so it just keeps reinforcing this in our minds. And so that's what I love so much about this book. Yes. Yeah.
In verse 3, the ESV says, gave her to Abram as a wife. Is it wife?
Yeah, I think so. I would have to pull up if you save that as a question.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wondered if they would have had an understanding, if Abraham would have had an understanding biblically at this point of monogamy, and like, can you argue that from the beginning of Genesis, like, you know, this is your wife, she's from you, and
yeah.
just monogamous.
One flesh?
Yeah.
I think from one flesh, there's, I mean, obviously it doesn't come out and say it, but there's strong implications of monogamy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, I mean, certainly this is not listed in a, what's the word I'm looking for? Condoning kind of a way, obviously.
Right.
I mean, and certainly I think we, on the flip side, we do have to be careful. There was not as much revelation that they have as we have. Mm-hmm. And so I certainly think it was wrong, although they didn't have as much information as we do. With more information comes more culpability. But I would say, like you said, I would go back to Genesis. It's clear that monogamy was God's way. And yeah, that's a good point.
I just wonder why, like, because then you have, like, the whole concubine thing.
All
these other non-marital. But here it says wife, so I just wonder if that's kind of just in passing, like, because they did what only a husband and wife should do. And it's just, you know, or if it really is all that should come with the title of husband and wife.
Well, I think so much of it is they took on the, and we'll see this later with Lot a lot, I mean, this, if we get there, they took on the customs of their day, even when they should have known better, right? And just like we do, right? We were so immersed in our cultures and things that we just do what the world does. And I think for that day, of course, polygamy was, you know, everywhere. So
yeah, I guess it's just hard because you don't see it being condemned necessarily.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. And that's where I would, for myself, I would try to hold a balance there between, it's clearly taught, I think, that it's wrong, but it's not clearly condemned. And so for me, I would say it is wrong, but you just have to give them in one, I don't want to say give them the benefit of not having more revelation, but they're in one sense less culpable than, I mean, he's a believer, right? I mean, he's going to be in heaven, you know, however he would, he's going to be in the kingdom. Whereas, I mean, maybe that's possible today for someone that's like so ignorant of scripture. But I mean, if anyone in this room, you know, became a polygamist, it's like, you're not a believer because you know so much. You know that, if that makes sense.
Too much is given, much is required.
Right, exactly. That's good. Now, other comments? It's a simple, short little paragraph and narrative here, but so applicable. But I just want to, that's what I was saying. I just kind of want to walk, in one sense, somewhat quickly just through these different stories as we continue to see these same truths come out in different angles. Anything else? All right, you could always come back there, but a lot there just to meditate on, even in those first few verses. Okay, so verse 7. Now the angel of Yahweh found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai. Then the angel of Yahweh said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourselves to her authority. Moreover, the angel of Yahweh said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they shall be too numerous to count. The angel of Yahweh said further to her, behold, you are with child. And you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because Yahweh has given heed to your affliction. And he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all his brothers. Then she called the name of Yahweh who spoke to her, you are a God who sees. For she said, have I even remained alive here after seeing him? Therefore the well was called Beer Lachai Roy. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. So in this section, it's an interesting section here. Of course, we have the disastrous results in the previous section of Hagar and what Sarai did, and the how Sarai even wrongly mistreated Hagar and kicked her out. And you just see God's faithfulness even to Hagar, which is amazing thing. I mean, she's out in the wilderness, out in the middle of nowhere, you know, as a pregnant woman, you know, and you get the picture. It's a pretty bleak situation. And God's faithfulness even to this Egyptian handmaid, just to be faithful to her. And I think, just once again, the point is God's faithfulness, God's mercy, his loyal compassion, even to this Hagar, you know, because obviously, yes, it's her sin, but it's also, and more importantly, it's Abraham and Sarai's sin, more even so than hers. And so, once again, just God watches, God sees, he's looking out for, in one sense, his people. And so it's an amazing section just of God's tender care for Hagar. And of course, you read that section, he will be a wild donkey of a man. We know, even just the results of this in history, the Arabs and just their, you know, infighting even amongst themselves and against Israel, and all the disastrous effects that have come from this lack of faith. And so, once again, the reminder, if we act in faith, God uses us, but when we don't, I mean, certainly God's plan has always worked out. We never want to de-emphasize that. But you see what a, in one sense, threat it is to God's plan when we act out of disbelief. How in one sense, I mean, God, of course, it's that tension between the fact that God is working out everything for his plan, and yet at the same time, he wants us to be obedient for the furtherance of his plan. And there's that tension that you feel as you walk through Genesis. And so certainly God used this, even though it was not right, and just the disastrous results of it is the conflict that resulted. Okay, anything further on that section? I would say just an emphasis on God's faithfulness. And so even in light of the first part of this, that God keeps his word, he cares for his people, the whole section ties together neatly and nicely on that theme that they did not trust in God, but yet God is God who can be trusted. Right? They did not wait upon God. They did not, you know, think that he would provide for them, and yet he provided for Hagar. And so you almost see those two themes kind of intertwining together in this one chapter. It's almost ironic how here's Abram and Sarai not trusting in God, and yet this Egyptian handmaid can, because God provides for her. And so, you know, obviously the implication is, well, they should have trusted in him too, because he would have provided for them.
Can you say that in God's fulfilling of the promise to Hagar, that is also in part of the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham, because they are his descendants?
Well, let's say that. I don't think completely, because it's a both. It's interesting, but let's get there, because it's going to be addressed almost explicitly in this text. It's a good question, I think, in this next chapter. Okay. Anything else from chapter 16?
You just limited me, but I did have a question. Is there anywhere in there so far that God has specifically said it will come from Sarah?
We're getting there.
Did you just ask that question?
What's that?
That's
did you just ask that question?
Not specifically in the same way, but...
Oh, okay. No, we're getting there. We're getting there. You're both getting ahead of yourselves. It shows that the narrative's unfolding, and that's part of a good storyteller, is causing you to anticipate things, and then he lays them out for you. So those are obviously great questions. All right, so more just about trusting in God, because God is faithful. All right, chapter 17. Now when Abram was 99 years old, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with you. And you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham. For I will make you the father of a multitude of nations. And I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings will come forth from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your descendants after you. And I will give to you and to your descendant after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Let's just stop there. obviously as this Abrahamic covenant is somewhat unfolding. Chapter 12, I wouldn't necessarily, is that first, you know, promise to Abraham, at that point Abram, and yet it wasn't necessarily given in the context of a covenant. Certainly the covenant language is more just given as a promise. Then as you get to chapter 15, you have what I would say is the covenant. You know, they have the breaking of the pieces, the covenant ceremony, the covenant terminology. But here you have almost a reaffirmation of the covenant and somewhat of an expansion upon it. And here you notice the language that comes in, everlasting. The key thing that I would say theologically this adds, and certainly you see that in the earlier covenant when it's a unilateral covenant, God's obligating only himself to keep the covenant, right? And so in that sense, if God's the only party responsible, it's somewhat of a clear implication that it has to be everlasting because he's not going to fail. But here that's made explicit. The emphasis in the text is this is an everlasting covenant. And you notice too just that statement, I will be their God, you know, and I will be the God to you and to your descendants after you. And so you come here and I would say this is the foundation, this Abrahamic covenant. This is the foundation for the whole rest of Scripture unfolding. Certainly with the nation of Israel, God has promised that the nation of Israel will be his nation. And his nation, he will be their God. There will be that intimate covenantal relationship between the nation and between God. And here there's this promise that will always continue. And so here, I mean, this is the absolute foundation stone to the whole rest of God's plan playing out through the nation of Israel. No matter what they do, this cannot fail, right? Because it's everlasting. And that's why I would teach, we would affirm so strongly that there must be a future for Israel. You know, and we could see that played out throughout the rest of the Old Testament very, very clearly, and even into the New. You know, we're not going to take the time to walk through all those passages, but I mean, I just finished teaching through the Minor Prophets, and over, there's that future for Israel, God's plan that's laid out here. God says, I'm going to fulfill it. I'm going to save Israel and bring them through the fire. I'm going to be their God, and the nations will stream to Jerusalem. They're going to grab, Zechariah says, everyone in the world is going to grab the corner of the garment of the Jew and say, hey, take us to Jerusalem. You know, we know that God is with you because you are God's people. And so you see that playing out even here. But this, Israel has a future. Abram's seed, Abram's descendant, God is going to be their God, the nation of Israel's God forever. And certainly, as we see the story unfolding, we see their lack of faithfulness, their lack of trust, right? Which is what we're saying is such a key theme throughout here. But we always see God's faithfulness, right? That they lack faith, they lack trust, but God never does. He'll always be faithful. And so they'll rebel and disobey, and God will punish them for their disobedience, but he won't wipe out the nation. He'll keep on a remnant. He'll keep his promises to this nation going and going to this very day because of these promises that he's made to Abraham. And so this is just, I would say, so key to the whole rest of Scripture as this Abrahamic covenant continues to unfold. And certainly we've seen, right, land, seed, and blessing. And these three aspects of this Abrahamic covenant continue to be woven together in this book. And here there's a major emphasis on the seed, that you will be a multitude of nations, and I'm going to multiply you exceedingly. The covenant's going to be between you and your descendants, literally seed, right? And so once again, it's just tracing this seed through Abraham. So just obviously just a key chapter within this section. Any questions on the first few verses there? Notice even there, like the land of Canaan is going to be their land for an everlasting possession, right? The land of Israel is Israel's land. God gave it to them. And no, it's irrevocable. Very, very clear.
So, in verse 6, it says nations.
Good. Yeah, I think that implies Ishmael. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good question. Good. We'll keep walking because it just continues to emphasize the same points. God said further to Abraham, Now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. And you shall circumcise, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be given, shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. Every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised throughout your generations. A servant who is born in the house, or who is bought with money from any foreigner who is not of your descendants. A servant who is born in your house, or who is bought with your money, shall surely be circumcised. Thus shall my covenant be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. But an uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. So, well, we'll continue on and go on. Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, will a child be born to a man 100 years old? And will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. But God said, no, but Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him, and I will make him fruitful, and I will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year. All right, so this gets into kind of both of your questions there, right? Certainly at this point, he changes Abram's name to Abraham to signify. Abraham sound, it's kind of a wordplay off of father of multitudes. And then Sarah to Sarai, they both have a similar meaning. So we're not exactly sure why the change there. But certainly both the changing of the names really emphasize a change of the character somewhat and a change of their identity as the covenant people of God. And I would say that's the main emphasis. It's not so much what their names mean, but the fact that God changed their names because he changed their identity. Right? Now that they are God's covenant people, and that's what they're going to be known by. And so they have this sign of the covenant. And that, of course, is circumcision, as is mentioned throughout this passage, that it's going to be a sign so that you notice that there's a responsibility on their part to keep this covenant, but yet at the same time, if I could put it this way, it's an individual's responsibility to keep this covenant, and yet at the same time, God is going to have an everlasting covenant with the nation. Does that make sense? An individual can be cut off from the covenant if they are not faithful, if they're not obedient to the covenant, but the nation as a whole, this must be fulfilled. That's unconditional. So there's conditional and unconditional aspects to this covenant. Does that make sense? To the nation as a whole, unconditional. It will surely happen. To individuals, if you are not obedient, you will be cut off. And so obviously the message to individuals is trust in God, walk in relationship to God, live in covenant relationship with your God, and certainly circumcision being the sign of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well that's... I think it was last week you mentioned that the covenant was actually a covenant that God made to Abraham. It wasn't something that Abraham reciprocated in the covenant fashion.
Right.
That it was a one-way covenant in essence.
Right. But
and I was just going to say that he made promises to Hagar, but he did not set up a covenant with her.
Good.
And the covenant was with Abraham and subsequently with Isaac and his descendants, but he still has promises that he's going to be keeping with, shall we say, the other side of the family.
Absolutely. That's right on, spot on. Right? This covenant, and everyone understands when we hear covenant, it's hard. That's a rich word for the Hebrew mindset. Hebrew, it's not just this contract, although certainly there's contractual aspects to a covenant, but it's also a relationship. And that's why a marriage ceremony is, you know, the closest thing really to what a covenant is. It's, yes, you make vows, you in one sense make a contract with one another, to be faithful to one another. But yeah, it's not just this contract that you sign, it's also a relationship. And so God calls for that relationship with every individual within the nation with whom he's made this covenant, you know, contract. Does that make sense? So once again, we know that Israel as a nation will continue on. God has made promises to them, but at the same time, individuals within that nation must be faithful, must trust in God, must obey him. And certainly, I think you see throughout this book as well the close interplay between faith and obedience. That's another thing that's really drawn out, right? That as Doug has said before, they're flip sides of the same coin, right? That the person who trusts in God, who believes God, is going to obey God, right? We've seen that's true of Abraham, right? And so the emphasis on Abraham being the man of faith, but also the man that obeys because he has faith. Right, he went out from his land, he obeyed God because he believed God. And so once again, that need for faith, understanding the eternal nature of the unseen promises. And it's even interesting too, when it says in verse, 19, you know, Abram said, oh, that Ishmael, because you know, Ishmael is his son, he loves his son. And so Abram cries out to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you, but God says, no. And it's almost stronger in the Hebrew. It's like, you know, God almost is like, Abram, Abraham, I know what you're asking for, but no, that's not the plan. And it's a pretty stark word that he comes back and says, it's kind of to answer your question, you know, yes, there are promises to Ishmael, but Ishmael is not the way. Ishmael is not the covenant line. And that's made very, very clear. Just once again, God's election, God's choosing, God's plan, as you continue to see it unfolding in this book. Great, great truths.
Well, it's like Abraham still hasn't gotten on board fully with, you know, because obviously if he and Sarah accepted Hagar back into their greater household, you know, that there was some kind of relation, a working relationship with him and Ishmael. You know.
Yeah.
And he still can't see that God can do this with him and Sarah. That's, I find fascinating.
Yeah, and even notice, well, let's finish this chapter because I think that addresses that topic. And when he had finished talking with him, God went up from Abraham. Then Abraham took Ishmael his son and all the servants who were in his house and all who were bought with his money, every male among the men of Abraham's household, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskin in the very same day as God had said to him. Now Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, and Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. It was the same day Abraham was circumcised and Ishmael his son, and all the men of his household who were born in the house or bought with money from a foreigner were circumcised with him. And so just emphasizing his complete obedience. And it goes back to the fact that, you know, Abraham is obeying wholeheartedly with everyone in his household, even though Ishmael is not, you know, like you said, there's that relationship with Ishmael. Abraham loved Ishmael, and yet Ishmael was not the one. He was not the chosen line. He was not the seed through whom God was going to restore blessing to the world. And you see just the disastrous result of his lack of faith in doing what he did with Hagar. All right, should we keep walking?
Do you have a comment to make?
No, I have a question to ask.
Go for it.
So, back to my question. Did Abraham, who became Abraham, know specifically that God was going to accomplish this through Sarai, who became Sarah? In other words, how much can we say that he was acting out of disbelief, and how much of it did he, afraid to say this, take matters into his own hands, thinking that he was actually fulfilling what God was
accomplishing? I think he actually thought that. I mean, I think that's a good point. That I, you know, he probably, and often we do that, right?
Sure.
We, you know, we think, I'm going to, God, you know, if I just, whatever, and anytime we sin, it's because we think that, well, I shouldn't say anytime, but we often compromise thinking that we can help God along in his plan. right? We cut corners, whatever we do. I mean, even, and it's a silly example, but let's just take like the seeker-sensitive movement. You know, let's make some compromises because we could think God, help God save people because we're going to kind of, in one sense, take matters into our own hands and not believe that God, using his methods, is going to do the work and the miracle that it takes. And so I don't disagree with you that he thought that, but I think the narrative makes a very clear point that he did this out of a lack of faith, and it was wrong. You know, and so he should have trusted in God, that God gave him this promise. God was mighty enough to accomplish it.
Well, I guess the simple question is, as I look back there, I didn't see anywhere where it specifically said, let's rephrase it, specifically said, I'm going to fulfill this through Sarah.
Correct. Is that correct? That's correct. That's correct.
And so therefore, when you get to 16, and he does do what he does, I guess for myself, I would agree with what you're saying. It just is interesting that God doesn't come in and condemn him in his actions. Whereas, like, for instance, and I realize now I'm really going forward, but with David, for instance, God punishes him for doing what he does.
Sure.
Whereas here, the punishment is the act in and of itself for what's going to come throughout all the years and ages. But God doesn't come in and say, you're condemned for what you've done. He comes in and reaffirms his covenant. But it seems like, as you've brought out, as we walk through here, you've got the seed of the serpent, and you've got the seed of the one from whom the serpent will be crushed. Now you see that seed taking a very specific, I mean, it's like now we're to the man of promise, and you have two ways that you can go even with him.
Right. And certainly even when it says nations will come from Sarah, you're like, well, who's that? Well, you're going to have Jacob and Esau in just a moment, right? And Edom, another nation, comes from there even.
The family tree just keeps branching as the narrative goes on.
Absolutely.
And thus the importance of just the generations and all of that, that he just keeps emphasizing that these are the generations of, so that we can trace that lineage to see where the promise is going to be fulfilled. So it just...
Yeah, and I agree with your statement. I would say it probably comes back to what we were talking about earlier, that it is... I think the narrative makes it clear it's out of a lack of faith, but yet at the same time, there's less culpability because it wasn't a direct command. And so, to me, there's somewhat of a tension there.
Well, you see it when he falls down. I mean, it's kind of easy to read past it, but where does it say it that he fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, I mean, this isn't just a small little chuckle. When you fall on your face and start busting up in laughter, I mean, there's a sense of like, there's no way this is going to be accomplished by the means that you say it's going to be accomplished.
And so even that would, just like Sarah's laugh in the next chapter, somewhat reaffirms a lack of faith, right? And a lack of trust where there should have been one. So I think that re-emphasizes that aspect of the equation.
Certainly not wanting to, but obviously bringing everything to 2 Peter these days, but I mean, it's the same fundamental thing. Judgment is postponed, Christ isn't going to come, God's timing isn't our timing. He will come again. And he puts that picture here. And so now you see that fleshed out in the life of Abraham where he's, I mean, as you brought out, 10 years goes by and he still hasn't seen it fulfilled. So he takes a step to do it himself. And then, you know, what is it, 13 going on 14 years later when he actually fulfills it. So.
And I think that just one of the great applications from this is... we need to not take matters into our own hands, right? When we think we know better than God how to accomplish God's plan. But God knows what he's doing, right? God's powerful enough to accomplish what he said. And so we just need to trust him. We need to wait upon him, even if it takes 10 years. It's good. All right, so we'll just keep walking through here. Chapter 18. Now Yahweh appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. And when he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass by your servant. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will bring you a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. After that you may go on, since you have visited your servant. And they said, So do as you have said. So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, prepare 3 measures of fine flour, knead it, and make bread cakes." And Abraham also ran to the herd and took a tender and choice calf and gave it to the servant, and he hurried to prepare it. And he took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed it before them, and he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. Then they said to him, "Where is Sarah your wife?" And he said, "Behold, in the tent." And he said, "I will surely return to you at this time next year, and behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. Sarah was past childbearing. And Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And Yahweh said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I indeed bear a child when I am old?' Is anything too difficult for Yahweh? At the appointed time, I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son." Sarah denied it, however, saying, "I did not laugh, for she was afraid." And he said, "No, but you did laugh." So there we have it. Sarah's, this narrative, as it continues to unfold, Sarah's lack of faith in a similar way, in one sense, to Abraham's. But before we even get into that, it starts off with this section about the first 8 verses, these 3 men visiting Abraham. And this part's a little bit, what's the point of those 8 verses? Why this whole thing about cooking and preparing? I think one of the suggestions that I read was that, even just having a meal, we kind of miss the significance of that, especially in the ancient Near Eastern culture. And often meals were associated with covenants. And so God has entered into this covenantal relationship with Abraham, and now God comes and has a meal with Abraham. And so it emphasizes the relationship that he has on the basis of this covenant. So I think that's the emphasis in these verses of why all this stuff about, hey, please stay with me, please have a meal, please eat, and how Abraham is standing there while these men are eating. It's just kind of almost this random thing. But I think if we would put ourselves into that culture where covenants were often confirmed with a fellowship kind of a meal, where it showed that these parties were united together, it's emphasizing that God and Abraham are friends almost. That God and Abraham are in relationship with one another. And so they come and they eat, and Abraham, God came to Abraham's tent. That's the emphasis in this section. God came to Abraham's tent. And we'll see that it is the Lord as this narrative unfolds. But it's an awesome point. It's all because of the covenant relationship that he has with Abraham.
That's what I was thinking. We think of God walking in the garden with Adam and Eve. And yet here, or the burning bush with Moses are these momentary things. But here, this is a...
sat down and had a meal.
Yeah, so is this Christ himself?
Yeah, theologically, obviously it doesn't say here, but theologically most people would probably say this is a Christophany, that it is the pre-incarnate Christ. When you have a man in, somewhat corporeal form who is Yahweh himself. So I would say that theologically, although that's obviously not the emphasis of the text. The emphasis of the text is just Yahweh came there and ate with him. But I would lean that way for sure. Yeah, it's a good observation. It's awesome even just to think about.
Well,
right.
But Sarah too is, shall we say, exposed to God himself in this.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought about that before. That it was like, okay, how close do you have to get to God before you wake up?
Yeah.
The pronouns in there are fairly accurate here in the NAS, but particularly when you get down to verse 9, and they said, speaking of the 3 men.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Then verse 10, he said, which seems to make it one man.
Yep. Well, that's probably Abraham there, the he said. The they said is the 3 men that probably, that they said to him, the 3 men said to Abraham, "Where is Sarah your wife?" And he said...
Well, I'm in verse 10, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
He said, "I will surely return."
Oh, okay, right, yes, those are accurate. Yes.
And then when you get down to verse 13, seems to be the same person still speaking.
Yep.
And it says the Lord said to Abraham.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right? So those pronouns are fairly accurate there.
Yes, they're right on. Absolutely. And so, as you say, with Yahweh, and we'll see here in just a minute, the two men leave, and Yahweh and Abraham are standing there having a conversation. So, as you said, it's pretty clear that Yahweh is there. Yahweh is, and that's why I said the emphasis of these verses is Yahweh and Abraham are friends. They're eating together. I mean, that's what eating together emphasizes, right? Especially in that culture, you eat together with people you know and you're in relationship with. And so God himself eats with Abraham. That's how you title those eight verses.
I'm certainly not one to guess here, but I mean, this isn't the first time that Yahweh has spoken to Abraham. So is it part of the reason why we can see when he lifts up his eyes, verse 1 and verse 2, and he gets so excited to bring these men into the tent that there's a sense that he recognizes them?
That's a big question when it comes to this. Is that why? I would lean that way, but certainly at that point it's a little bit...
speculative.
Yeah.
It just, the narrative doesn't answer, but it's just like, you know, I have people pass in front of my house all the time. I don't, you know, run
in. You didn't live in a tent in the middle of the desert.
Well, that's true.
I'm just teasing.
But the point being is that he did seem to recognize these guys and
I think,
want them to come fellowship with him at that point.
Yeah, as in some way, shape, or form, he seemed to recognize that at a minimum these were righteous men. I don't know. He knew something was different about these men, I would suggest to you. Yeah. And so as you come then to the latter part of this that we read, certainly the emphasis of this whole section is verse 14. Is anything too difficult for Yahweh? And even that word for difficult, it's like wonderful, or it's like a wonder or a power or a majesty. It's like nothing is beyond what Yahweh can do. And so the whole emphasis here is, therefore, you could trust in Yahweh, right? Once again, you could believe him. You don't have to laugh when he tells you, you know, I'm going to do this for you, right? Because God is able. He's powerful enough to do whatever it is. Nothing is too wonderful. Nothing is too amazing. Nothing is, I'd almost translate, nothing is too spectacular for God to do. Right? Nothing. And that's the emphasis here in this whole section. Therefore, we need to trust him once again. Believe him. Obey him. Even just, once again, Sarah's lack of faith emphasized when she denied it because she was afraid. And certainly there, that statement that she was afraid, fear and faith don't go together. Right? Even as 1 John says, perfect love casts out fear. Right? Fear and faith do not go together. If you're fearing men, if you're fearing consequences, I mean, obviously fear of God is different, but if you're fearing earthly things, you're not going to be acting out of faith. And so I think when it brings fear in there, it's a reminder to all of us, don't be afraid. Trust in God. Nothing's too difficult for him. Nothing's too amazing. Nothing's too spectacular for him. Awesome. Just to, you see how the same keeps hitting the same thing home over and over again. Verse 16. Then the men arose from there and looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. So you get the picture. The three men are walking towards Sodom, and Abraham's walking with them. And Yahweh said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed, for I have chosen him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of Yahweh by doing righteousness and justice, in order that Yahweh may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken of him." And Yahweh said, "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great. Their sin is exceedingly grave, and I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry which has come to me. And if not, I will know." Then the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom while Abraham was still standing before Yahweh. Right? So the two men, we're going to catch up with these two men in chapter 19, but these two men go on to Sodom, and so Abraham's just like left standing with Yahweh. As they've kind of left his tent, and they're, I guess, overlooking Sodom from like a hill or something like that. And so And Abraham says in verse 23, "And Abraham came near and said, Will thou indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within this city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth deal justly? So Yahweh said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account. And Abraham answered and said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes. Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking 5. Will you destroy the whole city because of 5? And he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. And he spoke to him yet again and said, suppose 40 are found there. And he said, I will not do it on account of 40. And then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall not speak. Suppose 30 are found there. And he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of 20. And then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. And as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, Yahweh departed, and Abraham returned to his place. So, awesome section here. Starts off with, I love this, that, you know, the men are walking. But I love this statement that Yahweh says in verse 17 and 18. Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? And, you know, he's about to go and destroy Sodom. And you see, what you really see here, I think, is Abraham functioning as this, if you could put it this way, priest to the nations. Priest to the other, that God says, look, he's going to be the one in whom all the nations of the earth are blessed. Am I going to hide this from him? And he, in one sense, plays intercessor for the nations. You see him, in one sense, praying as a priest for the nations. And you see just God's plan and purpose for Abraham played out here so clearly. Is that blessing comes through Abraham, and God's plan is through Abraham, and God is going to use Abraham so much that he doesn't even work out his plan without even telling Abraham. And it all just serves to reinforce God's working through Abraham, God's blessing of Abraham, that everything that God is doing here, and we'll see this even played out if we make it to chapter 19. We'll see how God works through Abraham. We saw that earlier with Lot, right? How God saved Lot in that battle of the kings because of Abraham. Because God had blessed Abraham, therefore Lot received, secondary blessing, if you will, because of Abraham. And I think that's really the emphasis of this, is look at Abraham. Look at how God is working through him. God is using him in his plan to bless the world. And so that, I think that's this whole interplay of the interceding. I think this whole interplay where God says, shouldn't I tell Abraham this? Because he's going to be the one I've chosen to bless all the earth through him. And even just, shouldn't I tell him this? Because he's going to teach his household the way of righteousness and justice. There's kind of a twofold purpose why he tells Abraham. On the one hand, because of God's plan to use Abraham to bless the world. And then on the other hand, because he wants to teach Abraham what true justice and righteousness is all about. And true righteous and justice involves the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah because of their wickedness. And so he wants, in one sense, to teach Abraham these two things. And so he includes Abraham within his plan and within his purpose. And so he says their wickedness is exceedingly great. And of course, we'll get into that in chapter 19. And so he's going to go and take a look and see if it's really as wicked as it seems it is. And of course, God knows, but he wants to go and check it out, in essence. And so then, as we said, you get to this section in 22 through 33 with Abraham's intercession for Sodom and Gomorrah. And certainly part of his intercession is probably because of Lot, his nephew, who's in this wicked city. But it's just interesting to see him pleading for the whole city. I mean, he's interceding, he's pleading for the whole city and for God's grace upon this city. But God wants to teach Abraham not only his grace, but also his righteousness. And so it's an important, important section within here. And you notice how Abraham is just, if I could put it this way, with a holy boldness, just pleading before Yahweh. It's awesome. I love just to see how Moses does this, how Daniel does this, how here even Abraham does this. When And even, you know, 1 John tells us about the boldness that we can have in prayer. If you are God's chosen, if you are God's son, if you are God's anointed priest, you know, you have that ability to go into God's presence and have that boldness, as Abraham even has here. And certainly he has humility as well. I mean, he keeps saying, okay, Lord, I know I'm coming again, you know. You see the mix of, in one sense, the boldness and also the humility. And certainly you see that with men like Daniel, who are constantly like, oh God, like, woe is us. But yet, you know, just at the same time, just pleading with God to act powerfully. And so I once again, you see God's plan for Abraham, that he's working through him as this priest to the world. And certainly that's to be played out as in and through the nation as a whole. And there's aspects of that that's true for us, as we are, you know, as Peter would say, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. We have that relationship to God. And you see some of those principles played out in 1 John and elsewhere, Hebrews even, where we can have boldness before coming to the throne of God and pleading with God that he would be gracious and merciful and that he would act. And, you know, we could get into that a lot more. But here more the emphasis is just what God's doing through Abraham.
Don't you think also deep down Abraham's saying, yeah, that's where Lot lives.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think that's why he's pursuing it down to such a small number, because, when you think about it, one just idea just popped in my mind as you're talking, is we now have, you know, like when we have these like bird diseases and a flock gets infected, they just kill the whole flock. And they may kill surrounding flocks in order to stamp out the disease. And I was just thinking that he's acting like a shepherd. Like, do we have to kill them all? Aren't there a few good ones that we can keep? You know, and it's just...
And certainly, that's a good point. Another major emphasis in this section is God's righteousness. God's justice, so that's why he's going to do this, show Abraham, all these things, is because he's showing his righteousness. And so God will not, and that's an amazing thought, God would not have destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah if there were 10 righteous people, 10. Out of the whole wicked, I mean, filthy, wicked city. I mean, as I translated chapter 19, I mean, we all know the story, but it's way more wicked than you remember from Sunday school. And I know you know that, but it's the whole city that's involved in this perverse wickedness. And so the fact that God would have spared them even on account of 10, I mean, just God's righteousness and his justice is really emphasized, that he is going to do what is right. And even within the fact that he spares righteous Lot, even out of Sodom and Gomorrah, we'll see that. It's God's justice and his righteousness, but yet his wrath on sin.
Well, you know, that's the way he was with Noah.
Yeah.
I mean, he does show mercy to those who are obedient. You know, he's not...
Yeah, it's like, once again, to take us to Peter, right? God knows how to judge the wicked and to spare the righteous. God knows how to do it, whether it's Noah, whether it's Lot, you know. And certainly that's because of his justice. He will not judge the righteous. He won't do it in the same way he judges the wicked. And so his righteousness is really brought out here.
Well, you see it too later in with the Israelites in reverse, where the guys had stole some of the booty and hid it in their tent. You know, it's not because there's, shall we say, 99% were righteous. Everybody gets off the hook. He nails the ones that are guilty.
Yeah, it's good. All right, so once again, just the emphasis in this section, really focusing on Abraham, what God's doing in and through him to bring about his plan to bless the world, and how we really see him in an almost priest-like priest-like kind of way here, interceding, being the one through whom God's going to bless the world, that God includes him on his plan because of that relationship. And And so I think there's a lot of implications there for the nation of Israel, that they were to be this kingdom of priests. They were to be this one interceding for the nations. They were to be the one pleading to God on behalf of others. They were to be the one that were all in the know, if you will, of God's plan. And so that the other nations could come to them and know. But of course, you know, we see that they failed in so many ways. All right, now, do we have time to do chapter 19? Alright, I got at least one yes, so that's all I need. Alright, chapter 19. This is a lot of lessons here, but we'll try to go somewhat quickly. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed with his face to the ground. Similar to Abraham, right? It's somewhat of a parallel, but also a contrast, as we'll see. And he said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, that you may rise early and go on your way." They said, however, "No, but we shall spend the night in the square." Then he urged them strongly. Same word we'll see later for urge, so you could kind of take note of that. So they turned aside to him and entered into his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Right? Very similar to what Abraham did, right, with these same men. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. Like, this is the whole city gathered around, and it literally, they're surrounding his house. I mean, it's almost like the same word that when a siege, you know, you surround the city so that there's no way of escape. And they called the Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like," or literally what is good in your eyes. "Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien, and already he is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they were wearying themselves trying to find the doorway. Just perverseness at the highest level. But it's interesting, as you start off this whole section, the two angels come, and where was Lot? Sitting in the gate of Sodom. You know, it started off like his tent was next to Sodom. Then he was living in Sodom. The gate is like the central part of the city. It's like where the happening place in the city. And he's like sitting in the gate of the city. It implies that he's like fully engulfed into their society and their culture. It's even interesting too. Earlier in the book, Abraham calls Lot his brother, but he calls the men of Sodom his brothers here. And I think that there's probably an implication there that Lot has fully gotten himself into the culture and the city of Sodom. I mean, he's been entrenched within it in a sense. We'll see how this plays out. Yeah, at the same time, you do see his righteousness, right?
I was going to say, how can he be entrenched if he is considered righteous?
Yeah, I when I say entrenched, there's a bit of a... He's surrounded by it, and yet it's a little bit even stronger than that, because as this chapter unfolds, you're going to see he's affected by it. As we see, I mean, not to the same level of wickedness that they were, but you can see he doesn't want to leave Sodom. And we'll see later what happens with his two daughters.
I was going to say, it's kind of a puzzling thing, because weren't his daughters under the shelter of his roof as much as these two?
Exactly. Women? I mean, that's even a great point. I mean, can you imagine what a wicked... It's this... You got... Lot is just this enigma, in a sense, where he's somewhat of a righteous man. He knows what is right, but he's compromised. That's how I think of Lot. He's a righteous man who's compromised. He took the good-looking land, and he went in and lived in Sodom, and he thought, I can be righteous in this city. I could still stand for righteousness, but it's just a lack of wisdom, a lack of... And you just see the results of his compromises. Even willing to give his own daughters to these men. You just see You see the result of him living in this city. And certainly just the contrast with Abraham, you know, who wasn't like that. Well, I'll read it now. It's just, there's this one quote in here about Lot that I thought was just so applicable, if I could find it here. It's a little paragraph, so bear with me. But where are we at? Chapter 19. There it is. All right. This is about Lot. Genuine faith is often hard to detect. Here was an upright citizen, hospitable and generous, a leader of the community who was a judge, meaning that he would screen out wickedness from his town and advise on good living. He knew truth and justice, righteousness and evil. He was nicknamed the censor. Yet in spite of his denunciation of the lifestyle of his people, he preferred the good life of their society. He preferred living comfortably in the city to living in the hills, where there might not be filthy living, but no good life either. The hour of truth came when the Lord interrupted his life. His true loyalty was revealed as godly, but in the process, his past hypocrisy was uncovered. The saint had pitched his tent near the evil city, but the evil city had controlled his life. Oh, he was moral. He knew great, great evil when he saw it. He opposed sodomy and homosexuality. Ironically, though, he would sacrifice his daughter's virginity to fend off the vice of evil men. He would escape the judgment by the grace of God, but his heart had become so part of this world. His wife was just too attached to the city to follow the call of grace, and his daughters were not uncomfortable with immorality with their father. Hypocrisy was revealed by the visitation from on high. As long as the Lord left him his own, he would hold fast to his faith but live in Sodom. Ultimately, he could not have both. Sodom would destroy him if the Lord did not destroy Sodom. And there's just kind of an interesting statement that he says there. Because we'll see later, you know, the angels like have to grab him by the arm and say, "We're taking you out of Sodom." Because he like wouldn't leave. He was delaying, you know. And ultimately, he was a man of faith. But you see how the city, in one sense, has got its grips around this man. Where he was living, he's trying to do both and, in a sense. And ultimately, we know even from the New Testament, he was a righteous man. He escaped God's judgment, as opposed to his wife, who looked back and was judged on the spot and turned into a pillar of salt. But Lot's this somewhat of an enigma. And yet, he's blessed, as we'll see, because of Abraham. And so, certainly you see just here just the wickedness of what they had done, and yet God's sparing. All right, let's quickly move on for sake of time. We could come back and look at this as a whole. Then the men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? A son-in-law and your sons and your daughters, whomever you have in the city, bring them out of this place." So these are the angels talking. "For we are about to destroy this place because their outcry has become so great before Yahweh that Yahweh has sent us to destroy it." And Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-laws who were to marry his daughters and said, "Up, get out of this place, for Yahweh will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-laws to be jesting or joking. So he's like warning them, "Get out of the city," and they don't even believe him. You know, they're too much caught up in the city. And when morning dawned, right, so this is like time had passed, right? Time's going on. The angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he hesitated. So that men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of Yahweh was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. So these angels just like, we're leaving. Bam, they grab him and they just pull him out. And so you see just he's this righteous man that's got to be dragged out of Sodom. It's this enigma. And it's just a challenge to each of us of how, I think so much of this is applicable to the Israelites, just how Canaanite religion, right, can, and you see that over their history, how the Canaanite religion can be kind of, they try to mix them. They try to hold on to both. They try to, just like we do, we try to hold on to the world and yet at the same time be Christians. And this just shows how you can't be a friend of the world and yet at the same time be a follower of God. And Lot is just this the result of one who kind of tries to live in the world and yet be righteous. He is a righteous man ultimately in the end, but you see the result of him living in the world. And ultimately it's just God's grace, as it says here, right? That these angels grabbed their hands, for the compassion of Yahweh was upon him. It's all God's grace at that point, that God just says, "You're righteous, I'm pulling you out of this city, whether you want to come or not." And you see how how his heart was tied to that city when the angels have to do that. And it came about when they had brought them outside that one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Is it not small, that my life may be saved?" And he said to him, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town to which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore the name of the town was called Zoar. And so, well, I'll continue on. Then the sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. So Yahweh rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from Yahweh out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And notice this verse. Now Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before Yahweh. And he looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, which when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. That's an amazing statement right there, right? You see, once again, that the reason why God saved Lot was because God remembered Abraham. And you see how God's blessing is flowing to Lot through Abraham, right? Once again, you see Abraham functioning as a priest to the world, to Lot, to his nephew, because God has chosen Abraham to be the means of blessing the world. And so that statement there, God remembered Abraham, is the same statement God remembered Noah, if you remember back to the flood. And so, once again, you just see God's working through Abraham. And of course, Lot's wife's lack of faith. How she turned back. She loved, if you will, she loved the world too much. And so as a result, she was turned into a pillar of salt. Lot escaped by the skin of his teeth, as it were, but his wife did not, just as she was judged. All right, and we'll finish off. And Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Then the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man on the earth to come in to us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with their father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And it came about on the morrow that the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you may go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus the daughters of Lot were with child by their father, and the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. And as for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami. He is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. And so you see this whole sad story end on one more sad note. And you just see Lot, this compromiser, if you will, with the incestuous relationship with his daughters. He didn't even know it. He's just, in one sense, just passive. And it's just, this whole thing kind of ends on a disgusting note of just his compromise and too much living in the world and not enough trust and faith in God. And yet, God in his grace spared him because of Abraham. But the whole thing is just this contrast, in a sense, between Abraham and Lot, between the life of faith and the life of compromise. Between God's, yet at the same time God showing God's righteousness in judging these wicked nations for their wickedness, which was so, so great before him, and yet sparing Lot because of Abraham, through whom God intends to bless the world. And then you see, you have the Moabites and the Ammonites, who are Israel's enemies all the way down through their history. Once again, you just see the result of this sin. You see the result of this lack of faith. And so it's that's why I say it's just a reminder of, not that this is not part of God's plan, because obviously it is, but you see the disastrous effects of not trusting in God. And so it's a reminder for all of us to trust in Him and to walk with Him. All right, I know we flew through there, but yeah.
When the let us make our father drink wine, is it like they're bullying him to get him drunk, or is it just...
It doesn't really say. I mean, certainly, I would say he pretty much knew he was drinking alcohol. But they just, like, hey, drink some more. And it just kind of shows his lack of scruples, I guess, if you will.
Self-control.
Lack of self-control, yeah. It certainly doesn't portray Lot in a nice light.
He does want to leave, because even, like, he asks the angel, can I go to Zoar at least? You know, I mean, after the angel, like, has to drag him out of the city, I mean, I'd be, like, ashamed or afraid to, like, ask for anything else, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, well, could you just spare that city so I can go there, you know?
Right.
And they're like, okay, but then afterwards he's, like, too afraid to stay there, and he goes to the mountains anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I don't know, he just kind of, it seems like it kind of takes a while to catch on to, I mean, more like that, I guess, but...
Yeah.
It's just interesting.
No, it is, absolutely. And just I almost see that episode with Zoar there as somewhat of another compromise. You know, they say, flee to the hills. He's like, you know, I can't do it. I'm too weak. You know, and just like, and they're like, just God's grace. All right, go to Zoar. I'll spare Zoar. You know, it's just fascinating.
Well, it doesn't really say much for his maintenance of his household.
No.
In
his wife and his daughters,
or, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in the very fact that he hesitated, okay? And obviously his daughters hadn't been, as we say, brought up in the fear and admonition of the Lord, because the only thing they were afraid of is the line dying out, you know?
Well, not only that, but he also had sons, daughters, and sons-in-law that just destroyed it, or destroyed in Sodom and Gomorrah,
mm-hmm.
too. So not a real man of the home.
Yeah, certainly.
Daughters were real broken up about mom dying too, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
She didn't die. She was in a memorial right there. Probably a goat and sheep went for years
Shaker.
From Salt Lake.
Oh my God. Yeah, I mean, sir, you just see the disastrous effects on him, his family, of his lack of wisdom and faith. I mean, just don't be about the world. You know, don't live by sight. You just see Lot living by sight so much, and just even as this thing trying to live in the city, the big city. I mean, Abraham's out in the desert, but Lot's in the city. And we should preach the message. Get out of Los Angeles! No. No. Flee for your... No, but... what's that?
Piper's already done.
But certainly you just... I would say it serves to reinforce and show like what living a life of faith is, and what it looks like, and what are the results of it, and what is a lack of trust, and even compromise, and those kinds of things. It just keeps bringing it back to, this is God's plan to bless the world, and it's through us obeying Him and trusting in Him. It's things that we need to be reminded of every day. Because nothing, as we read, right, nothing is too wonderful, too magnificent, too impossible for God to do. And so we can trust Him for it all.
I was thinking, like, when it talks about Abraham looking down in the valley and just seeing all that, like, smoke coming up like a furnace with the whole valley and Sodom and Gomorrah, like, where else, like, back then, like, we've maybe seen stuff like that with their huge forest fires and stuff, but, like, where else would they have, like, seen such a great, like, fire and, like, for a whole valley? Well, maybe they didn't have forest fires, but... Like, just all of a sudden, like, God just
chose. It would have been, speaking very literally, an awesome sight to see that whole valley just fire and brimstone, just smoking. It would have been, I think, would have made your stomach drop a little bit. once again, just God's justice, his righteousness. And just like in the flood, you know, reminded of that once again.
That's what's so scary when it says that God remembered Abraham there in that statement that you brought out, that Abraham's doing this little debating thing, and he gets it all the way whittled down to 10. You think that alone would save the city because of Lot's family. I mean, you've got 4 that went out of the city, so you think between the sons and the sons-in-law, the daughters, you know, that there'd be enough to be 10, and yet not even there. And yet, the amazing, it says that the compassion of the Lord was upon him.
Yeah.
Why didn't Lot go back to Abraham? If Abraham was so close, why didn't he go to Abraham?
Good question. Good question. Lack of faith. I mean, it just kind of, it's just in one sense you could almost, I don't know the geography of where exactly he fled there and how far Abraham was or what have you, but it almost, if you will, it's almost like he made this choice and he kind of just kept going down that path, and you almost just kind of see that path playing out until he's left in the cave with his 2 daughters and this horrible thing that happened. And so it's almost like just tracing where that went. And so he never really turned it around. And you just kind of see he just kept living that, in one sense, life of compromise, and what a sad way to end about Lot. All right, well, let's close in prayer. Our fathers, we have walked through a big chunk of your word. So many lessons for us here. Just continually impress upon our hearts the need for faith and trust in you. The reminder that you can do anything, that you are magnificent and powerful. Just the need for us to walk with you. The reminder that you will keep your word, your covenant, your promise. The need for relationship with you. We're reminded of all these great, great truths, and we want to live in light of them and just recognize that you do have such great mercy and compassion, even in light of your strict justice and wrath on those nations and those who are wicked and rebelling against you. So we just pray that we too would be like Abraham, men of faith, men who walk with you, men and women who are in relationship with you, and men and women through whom you are working out your plan to save and bless the world. We see that your mercy worked through Abraham and flowed to Lot. And Lord, we recognize as your plan continues to unfold that you desire to see your salvation go forth to all the world. And ultimately, we know that's through the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. So we pray that you would continue to open our worldview, cause us to see as you see the world, see your plan. Pray that we would be patient as we wait upon you, not falling like Abraham did, and a lack of faith, a lapse of faith, as he waited even for years and years and did not see the promise. But we know that you are able to do anything, and so we just pray that we would be patient as we wait upon you. We thank you so much for your word. We pray that you would apply it to our hearts. In Christ's name, amen.